Welcome to the Light. An Australian conservation group says it will build the world's first ever platypus refuge facility.
We're also going to build a platypus refuge, one of its kinds around the world. This refuge will be able to take up to 6 to 5 platypuses in a time of crisis. Right now there is so much to learn about the platypus, and we know so little. These facilities will be critical in building our knowledge so that we don't let this iconic creature slip off the earth.
Platypuses are among Australia's most unique and elusive animals. They're normally found across the country's eastern seaboard. The strange-looking creatures are the only remaining representatives of their family. They spend most of their lifetime underwater and alone. Australian authorities say the planned refuge facility can give them more information about the animal's preferred environment and breeding. Many habits of the platypuses have remained a mystery to researchers. Hungry for music? You can now order a concert instead of a pizza if you live in the German city of Frankfurt. Members of Frankfurt's Philharmonic Orchestra have decided to help music lovers now that concert halls are closed due to the pandemic. They offer short personal concerts at people's staircases for free. Instead, Frankfurt residents can donate money to the musicians, who say the main goal is to revive the creative industry.
We play miniature concerts in people's homes of about 10 minutes, and we deliver a longer route in our neighborhood so that people can enjoy some live music. For us, it's just beautiful being able to play for people again. What's great and absurd about this concept at the same time is that we play in order to keep a distance, yet we are so much closer than in a conventional concert hall, and that makes it so wonderful for us.
Those who ordered the concerts have called their experience delightful. They say the music delivery service has filled the void of the closure of theaters and music halls. The personal concerts can be booked online, performers observe health protocols and social distancing too. A rare black rhino calf becomes an internet celebrity as a video of her first wobbly steps has gone viral. The cute baby was born last week at Adubo Zoo in New South Wales, Australia. The newborn, yet to be named, has 3 siblings. Her mother is 18 years old and her father passed away a few months ago. Zookeepers watched the calf and her mother through cameras in order to create a proper atmosphere for them to make bond. The species is critically endangered because of poaching and habitat loss. Sophisticated scanning technology is revealing new secrets about Littlefoot. That's a well-preserved fossil of an early human forerunner dating back to nearly 3.7 million years ago.
Now, the importance of it is not only that it is the only complete skull of an Australopithecus from anywhere, but it is the only one with a complete skeleton as well. Furthermore, it is the oldest Australopithecus in southern Africa, dating to 3.67 million years ago. So it tells us a lot about our early ancestry. Now, we're not saying that Littlefoot represents a direct ancestor to modern humans, but certainly a relative, certainly a very close relative of our ancestors.
The fossil was found in South Africa in the 1990s. It's now being studied at a particle accelerator facility in Oxfordshire, Britain. The facility allows scientists to produce X-ray images of the fossil with extreme detail. They say the result has been fascinating.
The bone microstructure look amazing because we can really see the different tissues, the proportions, the thickness, and also the size of the different canals. So all of this make Littlefoot more like a living person.
So far, scientists have found that Littlefoot stood on her feet. They know she had gorilla-like features such as powerful hands, which enable her to climb trees. But she also had different traits compared to the human species believed to have first appeared 300,000 years ago. A Nigerian artist has become famous for his skills in creating art from coconut shells. Nathaniel Hodonu uses the shells to make stunning artworks in different forms, including portraits and sculptures, as well as home accessories. He collects shells from local oil factories, which throw them away as waste. He began his work in 2006 after his art teacher gave him two coconuts as a present. Hodonu now teaches art lovers creative ways to transform waste coconut shells into beautiful handicraft.
Tourism in Oman took a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic, sadly, much like many places in the world. But one village managed to turn its fortunes around by transforming some ancient homes into hotels and touristic attractions. Nestled in the high mountains of Oman, the village of Misfat al-Ibrahim offers some of the most beautiful and serene natural areas for trail running and rock climbing. Now the village has repurposed ancient mud brick homes into boutique hotels. The beige-colored homes with walls of handmade mud brick are elegant and simple, and the interior spaces are furnished with traditional wood and textiles.
Misfat al-Ibrahim attracts many tourists, so people and project owners in the village have planned on expanding touristic projects. You'll find heritage hotels, popular cafes and restaurants. We as a company decided to provide various adventure-related activities too.
The centuries-old homes were renovated for safety and comfort to combine old Omani life with modern amenities. The village is near what is called Oman's Grand Canyon and has somewhere around 800 residents. Many tourists have visited the area because of the heritage hotels and environmental components in the ancient village. These inns have attracted many tourists to the area despite the COVID-19 pandemic. Almost everyone has seen snowmen, but how many people have encountered a snow snake in their lifetime? A family in the US has awed their neighborhood with a fascinating ice sculpture of a serpent. The household in Colorado spent 10 hours making the impressive artwork in their front yard. They first created the shape of the animal and then sprayed paint on it to bring it to life. The sculpture measures 23 meters in length. It has attracted many neighbors and passers-by who occasionally take pictures with it. This is not the first time the family made headlines with their ice work. In 2019, they caught people's eyes with an ice sculpture of a tiger. A giant ice disc with an even greater message here. People in Finland have carved a humongous carousel in Lake Lapajärvi to raise awareness about global warming. An inventor and a team of helpers spent days in sub-zero temperatures to create what they say is the world's largest ice carousel. The rotating machine is over 300 meters wide and is spun by motorboats. The makers also carved another smaller disc in the ice next to it. The two carousels were commissioned by local authorities who want to bring attention to climate change and shortening winters in Finland. An iceberg the size of Greater London breaks off in Antarctica years after the first cracks appeared. The iceberg detached from the Brunt ice shelf near a British research station and is expected to either move away or run aground not far from the ice shelf. Scientists were expecting the calving of the iceberg to happen after monitoring the area with GPS instruments and satellite imagery on a daily basis. They discovered the first cracks almost 10 years ago, but they are skeptical about the role of climate change in this case.
A unique remnant of bygone days. Archaeologists have found a rare ancient Roman ceremonial carriage outside Pompeii. The carriage was unearthed near the stables of a village just outside the very city. It has four wheels and is made of iron, bronze, and tin. The vehicle is the first of its kind discovered in the area. Italy's culture minister has called it a unique find without any precedent in the country. Pompeii was buried under ash and a volcanic eruption in 79 AD. So far, about two-thirds of the ancient city has been uncovered, I should say. The lights, merriment, and traditional food. That's what China's Lantern Festival has brought to millions of people across the country.
Loneliness can hit anyone at any time, but it becomes severe during the pandemic-like scenario the world is going through. But some Japanese are enjoying the companionship of robots to overcome loneliness as they are unable to meet their loved ones during the coronavirus. The cute singing snowman is called Charlie. He is one among a large number of new generation clever robots being produced in Japan. manufacturers are making a wide variety of affordable androids as well as robotic pets, and they say their sales are booming. They also say their products have found favor with customers of all ages, not just kids. Studies have shown that therapeutic pets can bring comfort to dementia patients.
Spring is coming, and blossoming flowers are once again creating stunning sceneries across China. Clouds of cherry blossoms have created breathtaking views in Wuhan, a city known for being the birthplace of COVID-19. Inside the city, the main university is one of the best places to enjoy those blossoms, being well known for that among the Chinese. Students are thrilled to enjoy the floral scenery after missing it last year.
As the pandemic has been well brought under control in China so far this year, residents in Wuhan City, as well as students, workers and teachers of the university all come for the flowers and this warm spring.
In other cities, it is the plum flower that attracts a large number of visitors. They say the white-colored blossoms on mountains seem as if it had been snowing. Many of the tourists choose to stay in resorts that offer picturesque views of flowers. Many say they wait for a year so that they can draw a picture of the blossoms.
That's a wrap-up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
When the verdict came, it reduced the Paris court to a stunned silence. Nicolas Sarkozy was guilty of corruption and influence peddling and sentenced to 3 years in prison, two of them suspended. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy sentenced to jail for corruption. Stay with us for more of Kim Wilshire's article. When the verdict came, it reduced the Paris courtroom to a stunned silence. Nicolas Sarkozy was guilty of corruption and influence peddling and sentenced to 3 years in prison, two of them suspended. France's president from 2007 to 2012 had played an active role in forging a corruption pact with his lawyer and a senior magistrate to obtain information on a separate investigation into political donations, the leading judge declared, and there was serious and concurring evidence of collaboration between the three men to break the law. The conviction and sentence were dramatic, unexpected, and historic. Nicolas Sarkozy, 66 years old, had repeatedly declared his innocence and dismissed the charges as an insult to my intelligence. It is, however, unlikely he will spend a day in jail. His lawyer has announced he intends to appeal the decision, a process that could lead to a new trial and a one-year prison sentence can be served outside of jail under certain conditions, including the wearing of an electronic bracelet or limited home confinement. Sarkozy did not comment as he left the courtroom, but his wife, the supermodel turned singer Carla Bruni, on Instagram described the verdict as an injustice. Quel acharnement insensé, mon amour. Le combat continue, la vérité fera jour. Which translates as, what relentless nonsense, my love. The battle continues, the truth will out. And that was from Carla Bruni's official Instagram account. While Sarkozy was not banned from holding public office, the verdict delivered on Monday afternoon, 1st of March 2021, is likely to quash his hopes of returning to public life in time for next year's presidential elections in France. His centre-right, Le Républicain Party, LR Party, has been struggling to come up with a credible candidate since Sarkozy's former Prime Minister, François Fillon, was engulfed in scandal during the 2017 presidential race, opening the way for the current president, Emmanuel Macron, to win. At his trial last year, the court heard how Nicolas Sarkozy instructed his lawyer, Thierry Herzog, to offer the senior magistrate, Gilbert Azibert, a cushy job in the Côte d'Azur in return for information on an investigation into whether he had received donations from the ailing L'Oréal heiress, Liliane Bettencourt. The Bettencourt case was eventually dropped, but by then, an investigation into corruption and influence peddling had been opened. The judge, Christine May, the president of the tribunal, said there was serious evidence of a corruption pact between Nicolas Sarkozy, Thierry Herzog, and Gilbert Azibert. Herzog, aged 65, and Azibert, 73, were given similar sentences of 3 years imprisonment, two of them suspended. The case, based on telephone taps, became known as the Bismuth Affair. Paul Bismuth was the name the former president Nicolas Sarkozy employed in connection to two burner telephones used to communicate with Thierry Herzog. French detectives began monitoring Sarkozy's communications in September of 2013 as part of an investigation into claims he had received an illegal and undeclared 50 million euro donation from the former Libyan strongman and dictator Muammar Gaddafi to fund his successful 2007 presidential campaign. What they heard, though, from the recorded conversations pointed investigators in a new and unexpected direction. They revealed the former president, Sarkozy, and his lawyer, Thierry Herzog, were secretly communicating using mobile telephones registered under false names. Additional wiretaps on these phones picked up conversations suggesting Sarkozy had been in contact with Gilbert Azibert, then a member of the Cour de Cassation, the highest court in France, via Thierry Herzog to request confidential information about the Liliane Bettencourt case. Nicolas Sarkozy, who is embroiled in several legal cases, has repeatedly denied accusations of any wrongdoing in all past and present investigations. He spent years attempting to have the bismuth charges thrown out and the case dismissed. Thierry Herzog argued the secretly recorded conversations between him and former President Sarkozy were covered by client-lawyer privilege and could not be used as evidence. Before his trial last year, Nicolas Sarkozy had said he welcomed the hearing as a chance to clean my name. "I am combative. I have no intention of being accused of things I haven't done. I'm not corrupt, and what has been inflicted on me is a scandal that will rest in the annals. The truth will out," Nicolas Sarkozy told BMF TV. The former French president is expected to appear in court later this month in yet another case, the Big Malian affair, in which he is accused of overspending on his 2012 re-election bid. Nicolas Sarkozy is also being investigated on allegations of influence peddling and laundering of crime and misdemeanor related to consulting activities in Russia. Sarkozy's supporters have accused French judges of making the former president the target of an unfair and relentless legal crusade. He's the first former president to appear in court on criminal charges. His predecessor, Jacques Chirac, was charged and convicted, received a 2-year suspended sentence over fake jobs at City Hall when he was the mayor of Paris, but was spared taking the stand in the courtroom because of ill health. At the end of his 2-week trial last year, Sarkozy said, "This case has been for me the stations of the cross, but if that was the price to pay for the truth to come out, I'm ready to accept it. I still have confidence in the justice of our country." His lawyer, Thierry Herzog, was also convicted of breaching the rules of professional secrecy between him and his client. Thierry Herzog and Gilbert Azibert have announced they will appeal the court's decision and they will appeal against their conviction. After the verdict, Damien Abad, the president of Les Républicains, or LR parliamentary group, tweeted, "Today I want to again express my friendship with President Nicolas Sarkozy. His life has been a succession of trials that he has never ceased to overcome with energy and courage. Once again, he will prove this. I'm certain of it."
Yemen has recently been the scene of deadly clashes between Ansarullah fighters and forces loyal to the former president Abu Rabah Mansur Hadi, who aimed to capture the strategic northern city of Ma'arib. The fighting left at least 60 people dead on both sides Saturday. This after army forces and allied fighters continued with their push towards the oil-rich city, Hadi's last urban stronghold in Yemen, which is some 120 kilometers east of the capital Sana'a. Reports said that a high-ranking pro-Hadi military commander from Ma'arib's provincial military police also got killed. But last Friday was the bloodiest day since the start of the offensive on February 8. More than 60 people died in that fighting. Reports said the dead included at least 27 pro-Hadi militias. Meanwhile, on Saturday, several civilians, including a child, got killed in a Saudi-led airstrike in Yemen's western province of Hodeida. The Yemeni media said that a drone raid targeted a residential building in the city of Hodeida, also injuring several others.
The war being waged by the Saudi royal family against the people of Yemen, which is the poorest country in the Arab world, is an illegal war. It's a war of aggression, and it's also illegal and the targets that it takes in Yemen. 233,000 people are reported to have been killed. These are civilians who have been killed by Saudi air attacks. And a child dies every 10 minutes, according to UNICEF, in Yemen due to hunger and to lack of medications. And that's because the Saudis are illegally blocking aid coming into the port of Hodeidah. So everything about this war is illegal.
The attack comes as the sixth anniversary of the Saudi invasion of Yemen is near. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions. It has also reduced to rubble much of Yemen's infrastructure. The United Nations has described the situation as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN's humanitarian agency has warned that more than 16 million people in Yemen will go hungry this year as Saudi Arabia presses ahead with this notorious war. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that 500,000 Yemenis are already living in famine-like conditions. They said the risk of large-scale famine has never been more acute than now. According to the agency, years of conflict have created enormous humanitarian needs in all sectors.
The famine caused by the Saudi war on Yemen is part of the illegality of the war in general. It's been caused because the Saudis have been blockading the ports of Yemen, especially Hodeidah, and preventing international aid from coming in, aid that has been mandated through the United Nations and agreed to by the parties at international conferences. But that doesn't stop the Saudi coalition from trying to starve the people of Yemen into submission.
The UN says that at least 60% of Yemenis are food insecure, and 16 million people do not have access to safe water and proper sanitation. The war impact, compounded by the blockade and the coronavirus pandemic, has battered Yemenis. But all of this would not have happened from the beginning if the U.S. and its allies had not provided logistical military support and military hardware to Saudi Arabia.
It's shameful that the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France, Italy, and other countries have been selling large amounts of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the UAE. These arms have allowed the Saudi coalition to wage this illegal war on the people of Yemen and to cause widespread death and famine.
The Biden administration says it plans to stop arms sales to the Saudis and to stop supporting their war in Yemen. Many would consider this move as too little too late, because Riyadh has already packed its arsenal with huge quantities of arms that it bought from the previous administration and other Western governments, especially the UK. But almost 6 years into the war, the Saudis are facing an impasse, as they have not made any significant gains on the battlefield. They have suffered many humiliating blows from the Yemenis who, unlike their enemy, have stood their ground. The latest attack on Riyadh is one example. What the people of Yemen want to see at a minimum is a meaningful move by the West and the UN to effectively end this war that will go down in history as a war in which the U.S. backed the Saudi-led coalition and committed war crimes in that country.
The world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi Crown Prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
On September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings, killing almost 3,000 people. Soon after, then-President George W. Bush announced that time has come for the world to come together and fight a war against all those who seek to export terror. That announcement gave birth to the first war of the 21st century, the so-called War on Terror. 20 years after the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S.-led forces, the U.S. counterterrorism operations have only expanded. A recent report published by the Costs of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today shows that despite the talk of refocusing on great power competition, counterterrorism policy of Washington has not changed. According to the report, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Washington also owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That's while China, as the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. Another report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, revealed that the U.S. spent over $732 billion on national defense in 2019. That was more than the next 10 countries combined. The forever war has lasted for two decades, to the tune of $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The ongoing war has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and nearly 336,000 civilians have lost their lives, while only 260,000 enemy fighters have been killed. Some estimates put the total number of people killed as a result of the war on terror at around 2 million.
The U.S. has nothing positive to show for this two decades of terror and violence around the globe. What it does have to show for it is increased hostility toward the United States everywhere, which of course justifies, in the minds of U.S. government officials, the purchase of more military equipment and more interference.
Back in 2019, during a foreign policy speech, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden urged the ending of forever wars, saying that it has cost dearly for the U.S. However, Biden is linked to people who have strong ties to the military industry that is driving this war. Over 8 out of 23 picks for the Department of Defense agency review team by Biden were linked to organizations, think tanks, or companies which were directly funded by the weapons industry or were part of it. Interestingly, 3 of those 8 were employed in the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which receives funding from Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics, as well as other weapons manufacturers and oil companies. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics account for over 50% of the industry's lobbying. Defense companies spend millions every year lobbying politicians and donating their campaigns. That will ease the way for them to sell their missiles and guns and other equipment to countries around the world. Just 200 defense companies reported lobbying the federal government in the year 2020.
We definitely are. These are people who think war is the way of resolving any perceived problem that the United States has with any other nation. Diplomacy is not something that they have any respect or regard for whatsoever. This is proven in the various ways they have dealt with the situation throughout their careers.
The post-9/11 wars seem to be endless, and the latest figures and statistics approve that notion. Despite President Joe Biden's claims of ending the war, it seems the gulf between his words and reality is too wide. While defense contractors lobby for selling their arms and weapon industry lobbyists become Joe Biden advisors, isn't Biden administration then a war administration?
On Thursday, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the raid authorized by Biden had been, quote, deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions, on Monday. The American military base at the Erbil International Airport had similarly been attacked days earlier. The Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have, however, roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements. Pro-Western media outlets describe the U.S. air raid on the Iraq-Syria border as a signal to Iran, which they claim is using Iraq's PMU as a, quote, proxy force in the neighboring country, allegations that Tehran has categorically denied.
Joe Biden is a neocon. He has surrounded himself in his foreign policy, his national security advisor, secretary of state, ambassador to the United Nations, the Pentagon. He has surrounded himself with the same cast of characters to a very large degree who took care of foreign policy during both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. This is a very aggressive group.
Damascus has slammed the U.S. air raid as a cowardly act of aggression, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new president, Joe Biden. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, also condemned the U.S. attack as a continuation of raids carried out by Israel on Syria in violation of international law. U.S. President Joe Biden's order to attack the Iraqi anti-terrorism groups on the border with Syria has been criticized both at home and abroad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Friday that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the PMU facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. The Russian Foreign Minister said the U.S. military is present on the Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on the reconciliation in the Syrian Arab Republic. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. air raid, warning against any action that further complicates the situation in the crisis-hit Syria. Also, a number of Democratic U.S. lawmakers have found fault with the legal justifications of President Joe Biden's administration for the airstrikes, demanding that the officials at the White House immediately brief Congress on the matter. Many expected the Biden era to mark a departure from the damaging and warmongering approach of the Trump administration. It now appears that Biden is following the footsteps of the former president.
Really, Joe Biden has a career as a neocon who supported the Iraq war and the invasion and occupation of Iraq when he was in the Senate, and in a very influential position as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As the vice president, he was personally tasked with dealing with the coup in Ukraine and the overthrow of the government, the constitution of a new government that would meet the needs or demands of Washington. And we could go on and on. I mean, going back to wars in Central America in the 1980s, Trump, when some of the liberals who follow and support Biden said when Trump fired the missiles, ordered the missiles fired into Syria early in his presidency, they declared that's what made him presidential. So I guess, you know, we have to take it that making war is what makes a U.S. president a real president.
Biden authorized the attack in another sovereign state in his second month in office. Does he really have a change in the U.S. foreign policy in mind? Or are there more conflicts to come?
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, has slapped Boeing with a $6.6 million fine. It's pocket change compared to the multi-billion dollar fine the U.S. Department of Justice hit Boeing with earlier this year. The latest fine relates to Boeing's failure to meet agreed safety oversight changes dating from 2015. We now present you a news report written jointly by Eric Johnson and David Shepherdson. The piece is titled, Sources Say Boeing Hit with $6.6 Million FAA Fine Faces Much Bigger 787 Repair Bill. The piece has been published by the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us for more of Eric Johnson and David Shepherdson's article. Boeing will pay $6.6 million to U.S. regulators as part of a settlement over quality and safety oversight lapses going back years, a setback that comes as Boeing wrestles with repairs to flawed 787 Dreamliner jets that could dwarf the cost of the federal penalty. A third industry source said Boeing is being painstaking repairs and forensic inspections to fix structural integrity flaws embedded deep inside at least 88 parked 787s, built over the last year or so. The person said the inspections and retrofits could take up to a month per plane and are likely to cost hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, though it depends on the number of planes and defects involved. Boeing shares extended losses in the final hour of trading, closing down 5.6% after Reuters first reported the settlement with the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, over the plane maker's failure to comply with the 2015 safety agreement. The penalties include $5.4 million for not complying with the agreement, in which Boeing pledged to change its internal processes to improve and prioritize regulatory compliance, and $1.21 million to settle two pending FAA enforcement cases. FAA Administrator Steve Dixon said in a statement, "The Federal Aviation Administration is holding Boeing accountable by imposing additional penalties. Boeing paid $12 million in 2015 as part of the settlement." Spokesman claimed by email the plane maker is strengthening processes and operations to ensure we hold ourselves accountable to the highest standards of safety and quality, adding that settlement fairly resolves previously announced civil penalty actions whilst accounting for ongoing safety, quality and compliance process improvements. Two people said Boeing engineers are working to determine the scope of inspections, including whether jets can be used as is without a threat to safety. Another person said Boeing has not told airlines how many jets are impacted. People familiar with the proceedings said the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, has been investigating instances of oversight lapses, debris left inside finished aircraft, and managers putting pressure on employees handling safety checks for the FAA. The people said the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, has also wrapped into a single investigation three separate 787 defects arising over the last year that have triggered the invasive inspections. Boeing told the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, in August of 2020 about the latest flaw involving structural wrinkling in the interior fuselage skin, where carbon composite barrels that form the plane's lightweight body are melded together. A third industry source said the defect went unnoticed for months or even longer because computerized safeguards that crunch data looking for quality flaws had not been programmed to look for the gaps. The 787 production problems have halted deliveries of the jet since the end of October, locking up a source of desperately needed cash for Boeing. The fuel-efficient 787 has been a huge success with airlines, which have ordered 1,882 of the advanced twin-aisle jet, worth nearly $150 billion at list prices. But the advanced production process and sprawling global supply chain caused problems over the years. According to two people familiar with the matter, as of February, Boeing had fixed the 787 production process, causing the wrinkling defect. However, planes rolled off the assembly line with the flaw for more than a year at least, continuing even after the flaw was discovered in August of 2020. Boeing customer, Air Lease Corp's Chief Executive Officer John Pluger, told analysts on an earnings call on February 22nd, "It's difficult to see a definitive fix that is agreeable by the aviation authorities and all going forward." He added, I don't think that we're there yet. Boeing has been working on three potentially hazardous defects as it chartered plans to consolidate final 787 assembly in South Carolina starting next month at a sharply reduced rate of 5,787 per month. One senior supply chain source said they will have to cut rates again, but another person close to the company said there was no discussion of an imminent cut. Boeing said last month it expects to resume handing over a small number of 787s to customers later this quarter. One person said it has an ambitious internal plan to deliver 100 of the planes this year. Analysts say deliveries are not expected to recover to 2019 levels until at least 2024. But before any jet is delivered, it must go through invasive inspections and costly repairs. According to three people with direct knowledge of the process, first, technicians must pull out the passenger seats, open up the floor paneling, and use specialty tools to measure whether defects invisible to the naked eye are present. The repair work, already underway at Boeing factories in Everett, Washington, and North Charleston, South Carolina, is even harder. They said in the bowels of the jet, technicians have to remove multiple specialty fasteners on both sides of the inner fuselage skin, then install newly produced shims that fill out gaps and remove the structural dimpling. Workers then replace all the fasteners, repaint, and reinstall the interior. One of the people said, "It's like open-heart surgery," adding, "They'll be retrofitting the fleet for potentially several years."
Around the World with Reporters.
Israeli regime approved the building of 930 settlement units in the illegal settlement of Beis Gad-Za'ev in the heart of occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Anti-settlement groups said the new units will be established on land seized from the villages of Beit Hanina, Hizma, and Anata, northeast Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Israeli media quoted the Israeli mayor of Al-Quds, Moshe Lion, saying the new units are part of a plan amounting to 400 million shekels, around $122 million, to expand and support the settlements of Ramat Shlomo, Gilu, and Givat Hamatis, north and south the city.
This is targeting the Palestinian communities inside Jerusalem, Beit Hanina, Anata, and Hizma. It's a neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And building the settlements in there, in Beit Hanina, for example, they are expanding the settlement in Beit Hanina there. It doesn't leave any room for the Palestinian community there to expand anymore. Just need to block it either from the south by this block of settlement, from the north by a highway or bypass road that they are doing.
In addition to its attempts to expand settlements in the Holy City and establish highways to link between the settlements inside Al-Quds and settlements outside it, Israel demolishes Palestinian homes under the claim they are built without Israeli-issued permits. Experts say Tel Aviv continues to establish more facts on the ground, designed toward a greater Jewish majority in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, aiming to create a new reality that makes realizing the two-state solution and Palestine's sovereignty over the city impossible.
What goes on in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, amounts to silent eviction of the Palestinians. Israel plans to Judaize the city and conduct ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. It aims to impose new identity on the city.
Palestinian officials had warned several days ago that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was planning to build thousands of settlement units for Orthodox Jews to encourage unity among religious Zionist parties before the Israeli elections that are set for March 23, especially that Netanyahu has no clear path to staying in power. Some might argue that Trump's so-called deal of the century is dead, but the reality on the ground is different, as Israel continuously approves construction of new settlements on occupied Palestinian territory. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Less than 10% of the EU's inhabitants have so far been given a COVID-19 vaccine. This is minuscule when compared to the progress made in the bloc's closest allies, the UK and US. Vaccine producers have been grilled in the European Parliament. AstraZeneca is accused of not fulfilling contracts it signed with the EU.
How is it possible that you had no clue of your production capacity? Because what has happened is not a minor setback, it's a huge failure.
AstraZeneca is providing 60% fewer doses to the EU in the first quarter of the year than promised.
How does AstraZeneca explain the export of vaccine produced in the EU to the UK, but at the same time the company is not willing to ship vaccine from the production site in the UK to the EU?
The firm is promising to ramp up production. It says delays happen because hundreds of ingredients are required to make the vaccine.
What is made in the EU, as I said before, overwhelmingly stays in the EU, including the site in the Netherlands that was originally reserved by the UK.
The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was developed by Germany, but the EU signed supply contracts 4 months after the UK.
EU countries such as Hungary, Austria and Denmark are availing of vaccines from China, Russia and Israel. This shows divisions are growing within the bloc as nations break away from the European Commission's vaccination strategy.
EU citizens are growing more impatient by the day as they witness the health and economic impacts of the pandemic.
If EU would be able to press more intensively on the producers or pharmaceutical companies producing the vaccines, that would be wonderful.
Of course, this is the solution. It must be quicker because, you know, within 2 months, the summer will begin.
The European Medicines Agency, or EMA, is the EU institution that approves vaccines in the bloc. Producers were asked to comment on the EMA's seemingly slow approval record.
All of the data that goes to support the application for approval in the UK is actually being shared with the EMA.
One angry lawmaker suggested the only thing not delayed are the profits being raked in by pharmaceutical giants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
What the Saudis thought would be a quick military intervention has turned into a protracted conflict that's killed and injured tens of thousands. In 2019, a UN report said Britain, the US, and France might be complicit in war crimes in Yemen by arming and providing support to the Saudi-led coalition. All three have also provided Yemen with aid.
Britain will stand by Saudi Arabia through thick and thin because of that close economic elite relationship between the Saudis and the UK. So I don't expect Britain to break that relationship. And I think it's hypocritical, of course, that they are involved in this war on Yemen and at the same time are trying to morally assuage themselves by donating UK aid to that country.
By all accounts, Yemen is on the brink. And with this dramatic reduction in international aid by donor countries such as the United Kingdom, that man-made disaster is bound to take a turn for the worst. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's 35-nation Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting with reports that Britain, France and Germany are circulating a draft resolution to criticize Iran for restricting agency access. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi reached a temporary bilateral understanding with Iran over a week ago, allowing the agency to continue verification work in the country for up to 90 days. Grossi said the understanding was meant to provide a window of opportunity for political talks to get underway amid attempts to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. The possibility of a board resolution, however, is further complicating the situation. Grossi appealed for constructive discussions that would preserve the work of the agency.
The inspection work of